my audio. So I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside.
He said, if you can't take these twists and turns, man, I don't blame you.
So on cue, start bantering.
This was all the banter. This was all the banter. Well, welcome to Barnstorming. This is a special episode. This is Jordy Comis, one of the co-producers and co-hosts. We'll do quick introductions and then slightly longer introductions. But this is a special... why don't I go and do the quick introductions? I'll give you a little bit of notes. Let's do kind of names first. Sam, go ahead.
This is Sam, intermittent podcast host, guest host. And here wearing my member of Lycoming Tri-County NAACP hat.
Awesome. Adrian, you want to say hi and just a little bit about yourself, and then we'll do a little bit longer intro.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Adrian Miller, the soul food scholar who's dropping knowledge like hot biscuits.
That's good. Cherie?
Hello, I'm Cherie. I'm the warrior princess from Wilkes-Barre.
That's great. That's awesome. So today is a very special episode because Adrian Miller, the soul food scholar and author of at least two books, Soul Food and Black Smoke, three books. What's the third one?
The President's Kitchen Cabinet.
President's Kitchen Cabinet has... because the NAACP branch that Sam and I are both members of, that's Tri-County and a lot centered in Lycoming and Williamsport, is doing a Juneteenth. They organized for Adrian to come to visit us from Colorado and be a keynote speaker. So we're going to be talking about barbecue and food and culture and history and race and the complicated tapestry that is America. And Cherie also, first time on the podcast, but I'm hoping not the last. We got to know last summer in the uprising, and she came to Williamsport. Then that's the first time we met at an anti-neo-Nazi pro-community event. She's been doing amazing work in Wilkes-Barre with freedom fighters and other organizations. So let me just provide a couple of notes. There's a lot of Juneteenths going on across Pennsylvania. I want to highlight two, at least. One is in Williamsport this Saturday, starting at 10:30 to 5 is the official program at Brandon Park in Williamsport, which is just a beautiful park. At 9 a.m., though, up the road from there at Freedom Road Cemetery, and all this will be in the show notes, there's going to be visiting... Sam, can you rescue me? It's an Underground Sure. Railroad site.
It's actually an African-American cemetery on land that was owned by an African-American lumberman. Sort of the cemetery was created there by him. He was very significant in the Underground Railroad in our area. And the cemetery specifically right now is being a focus for this event because it includes the graves of a number of African-American Civil War soldiers. So Black men who fought to free people from chattel slavery. And of course they're buried there and not in, you know, the big Williamsport Cemetery.
Right. That's great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sam. I also, I saw that Lycoming College has a website about that. And I'm really excited between now and then because there's some oral histories there. From a woman, I think, who passed away. Maybe she was a Hughes also. So that's
yes.
Super.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been trying to share those on the NAACP, like a little bit on the Facebook website and Instagram. Mm-hmm. We can put the link to that page on Lycoming College. It's great. It's got all sorts of interesting pieces of African-American history in Lycoming County, which a lot of people are like, oh, it's so white here. What are you talking about? So
yeah.
Understanding the place that we're in from what unfortunately is a new perspective because of how we teach history.
Okay. Awesome. Adrian, you're at 11 speaking, I believe.
11:30.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And you're going to be around and I've heard that you're fond of signing books. Is that right?
I am fond of signing books, especially ones that I've written and people purchase.
great yeah. points.
that will be happening.
I listened to a podcast. I have to say, you know, because I'm such a like, you know, whatever, good liberal. I ordered your book, the Black Smoke book, but not from Amazon, from the other one. What is it called? Bookshop.org that's supporting independent book, but it hasn't arrived. So I was scrambling yesterday. I was like, I need to know about Adrian Miller. So I listened to you on the biggest part. It was like the biggest barbecue show in the country. Da, da, da. I forget his name. He's in Cleveland.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So I don't do that. That's the only time I've ever done, you know, the very like, this is a radio show coming to you live from Cleveland. Da, da, da. But he did have this funny thing where I think he will sign someone else's book if you, it was really funny.
Yeah, that was a new one to me. I thought that was hilarious.
Absolutely. So when Cherie comes back, we'll hear, I know there's also Juneteenth events in Wilkes-Barre and Scranton, and we'll put those in the links, but when she comes back, she can tell us a little bit more. She had to step away for just a sec about the Scranton one. Adrian, Sam and I have already talked too much. So will you kind of give us just sort of a thumbnail sketch about, you know, who you are and some of your books and your work?
Sure. So I'm going to say something that's going to immediately lose me all street cred on the subject of barbecue. I am born and raised in Denver, Colorado. Oh. But let me win you back. My parents are from the South. So my mom's from Chattanooga, Tennessee. My dad's from Atlanta, Arkansas. So these are the, you know, African-American food traditions are what I grew up with, even in an unlikely place like Denver. And I Stanford University undergrad, then I went to Georgetown Law School, practiced law for a few years, hated it. Then was going to open up a soul food restaurant, but I had a chance to work in the Clinton White House on a racial reconciliation thing called the Initiative for One America. Then came back to Denver, worked in politics for about 10 years. And then I just made this passion-driven pivot to write books on the history of African-American food traditions. So I wrote a book about soul food that won the James Beard Award in 2014 for outstanding scholarship and reference. Then I wrote The President's Kitchen Cabinet, which came out in 2017. That's a history of African-American presidential chefs. And Black Smoke came out just last month. So yeah, that's me in a nutshell. And then my day job, because all of this food stuff is really fun, but it's not incredibly lucrative, not yet. My day job is I'm the executive director of the Colorado Council of Churches, which is about getting churches together to do social justice work.
Oh, I didn't even... Gee, I was all sitting here going like, well, if Adrian's doing it, maybe there's a path for me.
Not yet. Maybe I might be there in a year or so, but not yet.
Let's see how many more dreams you can deflate on this podcast.
I'm here to help.
That's interesting. I had a few kind of lead off questions. So one was, you know, because unlike some of our podcasts, we don't know each other as well on the outset. So, you know, you said born and raised Denver. Is that what you said?
Yes. Born and raised in Denver. Yeah. Moved to a suburb of Denver called Aurora when I was
yeah. nine. Aurora is famous for something bad. Shooting.
The mall shooting, several things, unfortunate things happened. They had the mall shooting, with the theater. And then also Elijah McClain was killed here, more than a year ago. So he's one of the more tragic, one of the tragic murders that has happened at the hands of law enforcement of you know, murders of young Black men. And he was just walking home.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you don't mind me asking, that kind of suburb of Colorado, like how diverse or homogenous was the suburb you grew up in?
Well, when I lived there, it was very white. I tell people we have a lot of diversity in that area, and it's different kinds of white people. but now it's much more diverse compared to when I grew up there. So, you know, rough guess, I would say maybe a third people of color. A lot of immigrants land in Aurora because it's cheaper to live there than it is in Denver.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you're a fan of just immigrant cuisines, Aurora is actually the place to go to.
Yeah, that's often, you know, I remember during, you know, somebody pointed out during, like, you know, during Trump and him bashing immigrants all the time. And I'm like, yeah, okay, but you like the tacos, like, come on, you know, well, you know, all kinds of tacos, you know, these days, Asian tacos, all kinds. I'm actually from Knoxville. And I was, that was something I wanted to ask about a little bit. I was sort of an itinerant professional chef, very itinerant. Like I worked for about a year as an executive chef a couple of years ago at a restaurant. And for me, that was very much also a career pivot from having been an academic studying management. And for me, it was very, just very interested in like, how can businesses, be like, stimulate and animate like the networks of eaters and food producers in regional, economies and things like that. But I always love to cook with live fire, but it's not a tradition I grew up with in Tennessee. And I was actually sort of wondering, I only know a little bit about barbecue, but East Tennessee, Chattanooga, Knoxville, I don't really think they're on the map, are they? I mean, most of the barbecue there seems to kind of come maybe, but correct me if I'm wrong, kind of come from other places, whether it's North Carolina or South Carolina.
Yeah, so and actually, I've been to Knoxville a few times. When I was a kid, I went to the 1982 World's Fair.
We could have seen each other. I was there like every day. I was a latchkey kid. My parents were like, just go to the World's Fair. Leave us alone. That's funny.
Yeah. So, you find in East Tennessee is kind of a North Carolina influence. So a lot of pork shoulder. Mm-hmm. Places doing whole hog, but it kind of reminds me of that. You find more whole hog places in West Tennessee, and obviously because of Memphis and other things. So you're right. It does seem to come from other places, but I think those people moved there, about a century ago. So I would say that East Tennessee can claim its kind of own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cherie is back. Can you tell us real quick a little about yourself and also the Juneteenth that you're helping to organize?
Sure. So just a little bit about myself. Freedom Fighters, I'm a co-founder of the organization of Wilkes-Barre. We were birthed out of the George Floyd uprising last summer. Since then, we have really been working towards like putting down some good foundational roots so that we can do some good work and get in some good trouble there in Wilkes-Barre. Our Juneteenth event really is just an ode to our ancestors. We really had maybe a rally last year, but as a whole, Wilkes-Barre really hasn't had a Juneteenth event that is something that's long lasting. So we have a lot of people in Wilkes-Barre that don't really know what Juneteenth is. Like when I say it, they're like, what is that? So we want to bring awareness to what the holiday really is, what it represents. And this particular year, we really wanted to celebrate freedom in the way that it was celebrated when freedom was rendered, right? So we were going for a community event that would feature a barbecue. So under the umbrella of food, fun, and fellowship. And we also wanted to build bridges, right, between the community and the community organizations that supply the resources. So we're bringing Black-owned businesses out. We're bringing community organizations out, and we're bringing the community out. We've also reached out to our government officials, because as public servants, they should be involved with whatever the community is doing and embracing. And so we invited them as well. We really just want to have fun, but most importantly, we want to empower, right? And we want people to walk away with a sense of understanding and a sense of passion, a sense of pride, and a sense of poise. And so that's what, poise, pride, and passion is our theme. And that's what we're looking to infuse the public with and walk away with a sense of renewed inspiration and a drive to kind of be a part of the process of change that's still on the table for us.
That's awesome, Cherie. What time and where?
It's going to be in Cole Street Park. I apologize. From 12 p.m. to 3 p.m.
Awesome. We were talking a little bit about, I don't know if you heard some of this, but Adrian's from Colorado and the Denver area with some roots in East Tennessee. I grew up in East Tennessee. Is where you grew up, I don't think it's Wilkes-Barre, if I remember correctly, but do you want to reflect a little bit on that and how any food traditions from that, you're bringing with you into this moment?
So what's funny is that I grew up in New York, but I grew up to two Southern parents. So my mother's from Alabama, my father's from South Carolina, and I would consider myself a country and a city mouse. Every summer we spent in the South and during school, and in the fall and winters we were in New York. And the thing about food in my house, it was very traditional, in one sense. And then my mother took traditional and I guess she gave it a New York flavor, if you would. So food is very important, though, in my family. We have huge family reunions every other year on both sides. So for me and my sister, it was every year. And food is definitely a big connection, for us as a family. Fried green tomatoes, black-eyed peas and okra, we do that. You know what I mean? Collard greens, pot liquor, like that's a regular meal in our.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, while we're kind of going around, Sam, I know you've got kind of an interesting, we've actually all got some Southern connections here. Sam's kind of got two flavors of Southern connections.
Well, right. So I grew up in South Florida in Miami. So that's a very different.
So South, it's the Caribbean.
Yeah, basically. Like my experience with like charred meat is ropa vieja and, you know, carne asada and stuff like that. So carnitas, not strictly speaking American barbecue. But I also, my father's family is from Mississippi, Northeast Mississippi, actually. So I did used to go there in the summer.
So that's kind of the Memphis area.
It's no, we're not near the river. East Mississippi. Yeah. Columbus. So that is sort of a, I would say, a mark of shame in conversations with talking to people who are African-American. I am not proud of that branch of my family. It's been interesting learning more and more about that in recent years. Basically, I'm the granddaughter of a Baptist minister who was apparently very wonderful, but I'm a great granddaughter, actually. I'm the granddaughter of a fairly virulent racist and his wife, which is just how people were, you know. His son, my father, however, married a Jew from New York. So we kind of, you know, broke the script in that generation, and have then had all sorts of conflict between the, you know, Southern Baptist and the Jewish branch of the family. So yeah, there's all sorts of stuff going on there. I will say that the food tradition for me from the South is very much not barbecue. It's mostly really sweet. So ice cream, homemade ice cream. I'm like the Dairy Queen. And also canned figs. I don't know if anyone actually eats these, but they were big in my family.
I've never even heard of canned figs. Wow.
Yeah.
Sam and I have been friends for like 19 years, and this is the first time I heard some of that. It's one of the things I love about podcasting. I didn't know about the racist ancestors.
I mean, it's just grandparents who grew up in like 1920s Mississippi. What do you think they were growing up in?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Adrian, do you want to maybe draw some connections for people or share some of your thoughts about the relationship between Juneteenth and barbecue? I kind of skipped over. I don't know if people listening to this know some of this, and I've been learning, you know, as fast as I can, because it's all honestly a bit new for me. It was only made a holiday in Pennsylvania in 2019. And I've never had the honor, and I say this full of humility and also some embarrassment or whatever, I've never been to a Juneteenth celebration in East Tennessee, aside from the fact that I grew up in an overwhelmingly white suburb and all of that. It just didn't come up. So that's a long story about uncovering the ways in which we're trained to not, I mean, white people are trained or acculturated to not really see race. I don't really want to get into that, but Juneteenth is Texas. It's 1865. It's the general, forget his name, Gage or something, reading the order. And of course, Texas is so famous for barbecue. So I imagine that that's part of the merger of these two things, but you take it away.
Yeah. So for those who don't know, Juneteenth commemorates the day, June 19th, 1865, when Union Army troops arrive in Galveston, Texas. General Gordon Granger reads General Order Number 3, which informs people that they're free. And that, you know, and a lot of people focus on the fact that the news came late, because this is 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation went into effect. But I think the real story here is that the presence of Union troops meant that freedom would be enforceable. Because of the grapevine, I'm sure that people knew that there was freedom. I'm sure they had heard that, but the fact was there was nobody to, you know, make that happen. And so that's the key part I want people to focus on. So the early years of the celebration, it was really called the 19th of June or the June 19th celebration. Juneteenth, and nobody really knows how that got coined, but that doesn't emerge till around the time of the 20th century. But being a summer holiday, it's quite natural that barbecue would be one of the featured things. So for years, Juneteenth was equated in Texas with barbecue and baseball. And the baseball part has fallen out of favor with young African-Americans now, you know, football and basketball are no much more popular, but the barbecue was part of it. And then also this association with red foods. Mm-hmm. And so the idea was that red symbolizes the blood shed by enslaved ancestors. And so you should have red foods to commemorate this day. So barbecue fits in because the barbecue sauce makes it red, quote unquote. And then watermelon.
Depending on your sauce, but go ahead.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how does that work in South Carolina? Okay.
Yeah. But we're talking about Texas.
Right. Oh, that's true. That's true. Yeah.
And then watermelon and then some kind of red drink. And in soul food culture, red is a color and a flavor. I keep reminding people. We don't call things cherry or strawberry that they have hints of cranberry. It's just red. And so the for a long time, the red drink of choice was Big Red Soda out of Waco, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look back through emancipation celebrations that happened not only in Texas and other places, red is common. Some kind of red drink. It was early years right after emancipation. It was red lemonade. And then it would be a red carbonated beverage, those kind of things.
Do you know how they would have, sorry, real quick, do you know how they would have colored things, you know, pre-artificial back like fruits or?
Yeah, they would have used fruits. So raspberries, strawberries, sumac. They would have used
sumac. Yeah. That would be good.
Yeah, to color it red. That's a whole fascinating history. And so the thing is, that's another interesting history is that there were many types of emancipation celebrations. Depending where you were in the country. So antebellum America, African-Americans in the North or just outside the South would celebrate milestones in the international anti-slavery movement. Uh-huh. So dates that the British Empire ended slavery, you know, August 8th,
I do think it's important to point out, like, I feel like the British take a lot of credit for that, but they were still quite happy to trade with the American South. just to balance the record a little bit. Go ahead. Right.
And so some celebrated emancipation on the day that the Emancipation Proclamation went into effect. So January 1st, some did it when Lincoln gave a heads up that the Emancipation Proclamation was coming. That was September 22nd in 1862. So in Colorado, that was our Emancipation Day. For whatever reason, the people here decided to celebrate that day. And so there were all of these kind of, there was a patchwork of local traditions and Juneteenth has supplanted almost all of them. And it just shows you the power of Texas cheerleaders, right? They're mm-hmm. so proud of their culture that a lot of Juneteenth celebrations have started because a Texan shows up in a place and sees that there's no tradition of celebrating emancipation at all. And they decide to just kickstart Juneteenth.
Yeah.
Now it's gained so much momentum that it's well on its way to becoming a national holiday.
Yeah. I want to point out, I listened to, a historian, and I'm blanking her name just this moment. She has a book out now called On Juneteenth.
Oh, Annette Gordon Reed.
Yes, thank you. And she mentioned the general order, which is not a long document, but here's the second sentence. This is from General Granger. This involves, I'll just read the first sentence too. The people of Texas are informed that in accordance with proclamation from the executive of the United States, all slaves are free. This involves an absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, and the connection heretofore existing between them becomes that between employer and hired labor. The historian, Reed?
Mm-hmm. Gordon Reed.
Gordon Reed, thank you. She mentioned that he didn't necessarily need to have that second sentence. You know, he could have just been like, you know, slavery's over. And it was a little moment of saying, like, these people that you held in bondage and did all these horrible things to are now your equals. So I just kind of wanted to lift that up because I thought it was interesting. I have no basis for this hypothesis, but it also strikes me that June is a bit empty on holidays and Juneteenth just sounds cool. So it might've, that might've had a little bit going for it too, maybe. I don't know.
I don't know. I'm trying to figure that out. Cause I think it's interesting how that happened.
I mean, Juneteenth sounds more, I don't know. Yeah. Like emancipation holiday. I don't want to belittle the theme, but I'm just saying like Juneteenth sort of is like, what's that? It's interesting. Mm-hmm. I had another question. So Cherie, do you want to, I'm just curious, you know, do you have any early memories from Juneteenth? or recent, or I think she's going to come off mute now. Okay. Well, hopefully that works out. So did I hear you right, Adrian? Did you say that there was a different day when you were growing up in Colorado?
Oh, I'm going back into Colorado history. So by in the late 1800s, early 1900s, we had multiple days. So some celebrated September 22nd. Others did tied it to the May dates of the British Empire, either announcing slave trade or actual emancipation of the colonies in the West Indies. So those were in the early August. So there were multiple days. And it was interesting to me that people were just like, yeah, we're gonna have an emancipation celebration and they could do this patchwork. But by the time I was growing up, you know, I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, it was just Juneteenth.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Denver had one of the biggest Juneteenth celebrations outside of Texas. And as I poked into the early history of it, I found that it was expatriate Texans who started it.
Right.
As they do in so many communities.
Well, that sort of, you're being very, generous to the Texans about being cheerleaders. Gordon Reed talked about them being a bit stubborn, which is one reason why they hadn't stopped fighting in the Civil War. Those may be different. It was interesting to hear the interview because she herself is a Texan and was kind of owning that. But of course, this year, Texas being like, we're going to be the last bastion of a slave republic. It was just kind of an interesting moment. It's a really good interview. I'll put it in the show notes. I recommend people. Yes, Sam.
I'm curious about, Cherie had said, you know, making sure people know about Juneteenth. And I'm curious, I'm pretty sure like no one where I'm from knew about Juneteenth in the 70s and 80s. Like it was just not on the radar in South Florida. I have no idea in other places, but I really think maybe the first time I heard about it was in the early 2000s. And I actually recently realized I have documentation of when it started getting through to me because I make calendars for my family. And I included it in the calendar for the first time in 2009, which means I was putting the calendar together in 2008, right after the election of Barack Obama. So I'd been working on that campaign and just as a volunteer, but it made the calendar that year. But then I didn't put it in again. Like, I think I probably got to the next year and I'm like, should I put that in? And I'm giving it to my in-laws and, you know, how do they feel about this? But I put it in again, starting in 2015, and it's been in every year since. And that's basically, Ferguson was in flames at the time that I was making the calendar. I'm like, it's in, like, no questions.
Yeah. Well, no, I think that's really interesting. And I'm hoping that somebody will trace the cultural history of Juneteenth, because it does seem very apparent that it increases in notoriety and popularity after our nation experiences some racial justice moment. So Ferguson was certainly that. But I just think the murders of Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and George Floyd really brought a consciousness to Juneteenth. And, George Floyd was killed in late May. Juneteenth was just a few weeks after that. And it was a rallying cry for justice. And Juneteenth, I think, has, because of the word coming late and the enforceability and all these things, Juneteenth has been a reminder that freedom remains elusive unless some other things happen, and that we're not all free until everyone is free. And so I think that's one thing that's spurring the momentum for Juneteenth become a national holiday.
Right. We're planning on having things about the petition to make it a national holiday at our event and promoting that. Maybe you can symbolically sign a huge piece of paper, but we're really going to be driving people to the online petition, basically. I'm just wondering, like, Cherie had mentioned that, you know, she just wants the people to know. Is it only white people who don't know about it, or are there also African Americans who are not familiar with this?
Oh yeah, there's a ton of African Americans who don't know about it. And again, it's not until somebody brings it to their attention, really, because there's a certain arc to remembrance. And so what we find is in the decades right after the Civil War and after emancipation, these emancipation celebrations were plentiful all over the country. But after that first generation you know, the kids don't feel connected to it, and it just fades away. So one thing that's been interesting about Juneteenth is how it's had some staying power. And the other thing to understand is that a lot of the emancipation celebrations of the first generation were very somber and almost quasi-sacred gatherings. So it would usually was hosted by a church. And one of the things I thought resonated really me just looking back through historical sources is that they would have formerly enslaved people there to talk about their experiences so that people would not forget. And unfortunately we did, because these ceremonies ceased. And I think once that generation died, you know, it just lost momentum. And now I know that there's a social justice aspect to it. So one of my hopes is that Juneteenth just doesn't become a party. That the social justice aspect, the remembrance, will always be a part of it.
Clint, is his name Clint Smith, the author of How the Word is Passed. He talks about how when the Museum of African American History and Culture opened in DC, there was a woman on hand who had known, she was like 102, but she had known people who had been enslaved as a child. And so he's pointing out, he's like, this is not, you know, antediluvial history, right? Like this is part of our culture. It is not that far back. It extends far back, right? It extends, it's this very, you know, original sin, right? The 1619 Project reminds us of that. But it lasted. And I think actually it's interesting you're describing, I think one of the things you're describing, like Cherie said, that last year in Wilkes-Barre, they had observed it with a protest. And I know that for Williamsport, actually this year, there's a lot of pressure to have it as a celebratory event in contrast. Like let's come together as and celebrate African-American culture and celebrate, you know, liberation and celebrate. But I do hear you saying that, you know, that loses something, right? That loses the weight and significance.
Yeah. And, you know, my hope is that all of these things are integrated, right? Just make it woven just so it connects to the past. And then, you know, because of our past, we have so much to celebrate, but we know that the work's not done because things that are still happening now.
Yes, certainly. I mean, right.
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking, you know, about some of these conversations. There's some interesting maybe parallels. I mean, one is, you know, from what I know about the history of Thanksgiving, that was also lots of different traditions, and it was Lincoln who unified it into more of a codified holiday. And then, you know, Memorial Day and the 4th of July should be, I don't know, should, but you can imagine reasons that those would be very somber, and they've both also been a bit partyified. Yeah. So it seems like.
Did you even hear, Jordy, about like people have been recovering the history of Memorial Day?
I did hear that.
Yes.
The one in South Carolina? Was it South Carolina?
Well, and just that it was basically, right, it was a post-Civil War honoring by African Americans,
yes,
of Union dead,
yeah,
in Charleston, South Carolina.
In Charleston, South Carolina. I did see that because I saw it first, the controversy. I don't know if you saw this, Adrian, but there was an American Legion event in Ohio, I think, and a retired general was sharing this, and they cut his mic because they decided they had seen it in his prescript, and they were like, oh, that's too controversial. And then I was like, what? I know, absolutely. It's just, and you know, I don't know a lot about the American Legion, but I did see that they are sort of internally taking action about disciplining that because it was wildly inappropriate.
Was the speaker white?
Yeah. Yes, it was a white general. And he was like, I fought. In fact, it's beautiful because he's like, I fought for this country and for freedom. And I want to share this because it's not well known. And I think the history on it came in the last 5 or 10 years, maybe. But I don't know if you've seen it. But in Charleston, there was this, I think it was a racetrack, and it was an unmarked mass grave of Union soldiers, you know, all that. So this is for the audience. Unmarked, if I remember correctly, it was unmarked Union soldiers. And right around the end of the war, emancipation, yes, like sort of spontaneously, there was this collective action by the formerly enslaved people to go and dig them up and give them a proper burial. And it was so sacred. And that story, you know, I'm sorry, I'm talking so much, but recently I got into a bit of I sometimes kind of stir the pot online, but some local, very bright conservative people were bemoaning that Americans are not extremely proud. And I was like, I don't know what that means, but when I see that, that's a moment that makes me very proud of like the real history, right, of this country, and like how much magnanimity and grace, right, to have been through that, and then to want to, I can't even fathom the kinds of hardships, of course, enslaved people suffered, but then to do that, you know, that to me is like, what could be more American than that? Yeah. Go ahead, Adrian, sorry.
No, it's interesting, as you know, and that's been part of the journey, so I'm glad that there's more awareness of Juneteenth, that it's growing, and it's giving people a peek into African-American culture that they may not have had. And I hope it's a springboard to more exploration.
Right.
The fact that people don't know it is exactly like it's perfect for the moment, because people are all arguing, no, only teach X for history. And it's like, this is a huge thing. And I bet you don't know anything about it, you know? Yeah. And who does it serve for you to not know anything about it, right? Who does it serve for people not to like have ever heard of Frederick Douglass's book, you know, What to the Slave is the 4th of July? That's what Juneteenth is about, and it's about the people who are very hung up on the Constitution, which is a useful document. It talks about a more perfect union. Juneteenth is about perfecting 4th of July.
Yeah. Yeah. I was earlier, you know, we were talking about memory. I was thinking, you know, forgetting is an active exercise. Sometimes it's not just that it happens. And you know, we know there's been a lot of enforced forgetting. I don't know if this will quite work, but half of my family is immigrant, Adrian. My father immigrated from Barcelona. And so in the other interview, I heard you talking about sort of origins of American barbecue and the Native American theory and African-American. You know, one thing that occurred to me is a dish that's very close to my heart is paella. I don't know if you've ever had it, but it's a rice dish that most traditionally is cooked over fire. And the connection there between food and forgetting is that, and what we were saying earlier is that the Spanish Civil War, you know, Spain's modern society, Franco died in 77. The transition to the current constitutional democracy was in 79 to 80. There was like, we're not going to do this. We're not going to talk about it. And they're still digging up mass graves. And, you know, that was 90 years more recently than the yeah. Civil War. But, you know, I feel like very few countries offer us a really good model for that reconciliation process. And I don't know hardly anything, but it seems like South Africa tried to do it. To me, some of the, I'm going way out here, but it seems to me the talk about reparations or whether that's sort of across the United States or with Tulsa, it's part of that. We never did that. I mean, Sam's heard me say this. I think for me, my realization is that I think we're still, you know, in 200 years, if somebody's writing the history, they may talk about this period now as the last chapter of Reconstruction. We never finished Reconstruction.
Never finished it. But there were reparations. What people should know is that out of slavery, all the white slave owners got compensated. So there were reparations.
Just
African Americans.
Well, a lot of people know about 40 acres and a mule. And they don't know that they never got it.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Which is insane. It's like you learn this thing. Oh, they are. And it's like, nope, didn't happen. Yeah. Like it was proposed, you know, and it's just like, that's, I mean, my history is very heavily architecture based because that's my field.
Well, because you're an architect. Yes. It makes a lot of sense.
It does. But it also like I had very substandard like high school history, and like I never took any AP history or anything, and basically the only thing I remember about Reconstruction, I mean I remember my American history class very clearly, and that there was almost nothing in there. They talked about mugwumps and carpetbaggers, and that was it, you know, basically. There were a couple of dates, so all of the stuff about, you know, Tulsa, the, you know, the white coup in Wilmington, Delaware, things like that happening all over. I do feel like now I inhale history fairly regularly. I have been reading, you know.
That's not the recommended mode of consumption.
Right, right. Like Richard Rothstein's book, The Color of Law, and, you know, really fascinated by these things. And these are books that, this is scholarship that's coming out now. You know, people are analyzing these things, putting together the pieces, because maybe growing up in Florida, I did know about Rosewood, which was a massacre in Florida of an African-American community. I knew about that, but that was like our personal shame, right? It was like, Florida did this bad thing, but it wasn't visible to us as part of a pattern all over the country, because there was no mechanism for sharing that, because it was sort of like, oh, only some people know about that. It's not talked about, you know, which is insane. And that's exactly what everyone is arguing about right now. Like, how the word is passed, who gets to say, and what gets talked about.
Yeah. And I just want to say something real quick about the mechanism. There were mechanisms to share this information, but, you know, it goes to your point about people decided what to share. Because when it came to the point of putting out images and information that would ridicule and undermine African-Americans, that was widely disseminated. And even though some of this stuff generated in the South, there were plenty of media content providers who were happy to replay or share these this information that would denigrate African-Americans around the country. So, yeah.
Hey, Cherie is back in a good place. You got the mic, you know, do you want to talk about Juneteenth or what we were just talking about? Oh, you got to mute.
Definitely enjoying the dialogue back and forth. I think like Juneteenth needs to be just as important as a 4th of July. It is to me anyway, you know? And so one of the reasons why I really wanted to have an event is just simply because there's a lot of things about American history that have yet to be unearthed, yet to be uncovered. Not that it's not known, it's just not widely spread. And what I found is that a lot of people in my own community, I just was in the store buying some bundt cake pans for our red velvet cake. And both of the cashiers were like, you know, well, who's making all this cake? And I said, it's for our Juneteenth celebration. You know, we're having red velvet cake. And they're like, Juneteenth, you know, what's that? And, you know, honestly, I didn't know about Juneteenth until the Blackish episode, which I think is like historic. Like, that's a phenomenal episode. But until I saw it, I really didn't know what Juneteenth was either. And so, you know, I just know that there are so many pockets in my own community that are still not connected to Juneteenth. And I wanted to really kind of build that bridge, right, between history and the community, and just making sure that it's not, you know, something that turns into like, you know, Santa Claus and Easter Bunny. It's very commercialized right now. I just see it everywhere, but I don't really feel like a lot of people have an understanding about it. And so what's important for me is people that really understand the history of it and really get a good sense of, you know, why it is that we celebrate it. And I think Adrian made a very good point in reference to the social movement aspect of it. Like for us, you know, we're going to rally around livable wages, you know, minimum raise the wage, but we're not going to let people leave without taking a step, taking an action, being a part. And that's really important. I think, you know, to the research that I've done, it's really about, you know, the arts, right? About social movement and just being conscious, you know, and being active and being a part. And just really want to pass the baton. The young people are really close to my heart. And just want to make sure that this history doesn't get lost in translation, but that it stays authentic and stays true to what it really, really, really is, right? It was a thing, but it is a thing. And I just want to make those connections for our young people as well.
Yeah, no, that's great, Tree. And I love the story about talking to the cashier. I've heard Adrian talk about this, but you know, that one of the things about Juneteenth and in general is that food is this place that we can maybe break down some of those barriers. Is that something you've seen happen in particular around Juneteenth or just in general? Because I heard you talk about it. I didn't know if you had any specific like examples of the ways in which food maybe kind of helps to have some of these conversations.
So our menu has actually been a highlight of conversation between a lot of the organizations that we've invited to the event, because it's like, why not hamburgers and hot dogs, right? Why brisket? Why ribs, right? Why black eyed peas? Why collard greens, right?
I don't know why anyone, that food is so superior, but anyway, go ahead.
But yeah, but it's the question, right? Like, why not Frank's? Why not? Why does it have to be specific? And it was really important for there to be some authentic cuisine. You know, throughout my life, again, food has been a place of healing, food has been a place of conversation. Food has been a place of education. Like a lot of things historically for us happen over food. It's so important to our culture. And so what was important for me was to have an authentic feel, right? Not this, again, commercialized feel, but really bring the community into this experience of Juneteenth. And I think the food is significant. It definitely, in my research, which is not, you know, extensive, but I wanted to be true to the holiday. So I definitely did some research. And just the fact that like the black eyed peas and the collard greens was a symbol of wealth, you know, and just the different meanings behind the food. And I mean, you know, Jordy, I have to agree with you. It's just darn good, right? So, you know, like, why not? But it was important that at this event, we kind of brought that side of it, like it raised the importance of the cuisine being authentic and just even the games, you know, like we have like the potato sack race, the egg race, you know, we have the three-legged man race. There's just a lot of nostalgia there. And of course, as we move through the years, we have Double Dutch and this game, I don't even know the name of it, but it's like with these cats and they on the ground, hopscotch. We didn't want to bring in like new school games. We wanted to bring in some games that again were historic and authentic. And so the whole event really is around bringing the feel of what it may have felt like, you know, on that, you know, those original holidays. Like we don't know exactly what they did or how they did it, but we wanted to bring some sense of a feel of the history of it. So we're hoping that gets accomplished, but it's definitely been the strategy that we've been circling around the event.
Sure. Are there, Adrian, are there ever, are there specific barbecue dishes that are even either regionally or generally like that is the Juneteenth barbecue dish, or is it just any kind of barbecue?
Well, the only thing that I ever saw that was specific was there was a Juneteenth goat tradition that was observed in some parts of Texas. So it didn't seem like it was widespread, but it was common enough that it actually got that designation. But other than that, you know, I just follow kind of the general trends in Texas barbecue. So brisket, spare ribs, chicken, and sausage.
Is brisket, you know, like is brisket, and I was thinking about some of the comments you had about saucing, and what went through my mind is that it may also be the case that there are origins of having access, of only being able to have some of the tougher cuts of meat, which cook longer or whatever. So I didn't know, I don't know the history of using brisket, but general, like we love these cuts now in barbecue, but often they were considered almost the throwaway cuts. Am I right?
Yeah. So what you find like roughly 100 years ago, there was this transition because barbecue for 200 years was whole animal cooking.
Mm-hmm.
There may be pork shoulders cooked here and there, but overall it was whole animal cooking. So it really isn't until 100 years ago that you get this transition to cooking smaller cuts of meat. And that leads to a bunch of innovation. That's where all of these regional styles start developing because it was pretty standardized. And so, it was the lesser cuts of meat, the tougher cuts. And so barbecue was considered art, right? It was, how do you transform this hard to eat thing into something that's utterly delicious?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Low and slow. I mean, it's it's funny to me. Sometimes there are lots of books because I'm like, it's not that hard.
Yeah.
Do you really need a Wi-Fi? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah. You know, there's so much information now on cooking barbecue. If you're just practically lazy if you're not a good barbecue cook, because there's so much information out there now. But I just want to just amend something. You mentioned low and slow. I know plenty of African-Americans who cook hot, fast, then slow.
Okay.
So it just depends on whether you're cooking above the heat source or indirect.
Yeah. I've done most of my stuff just on a kettle, Weber grill. So maybe that's why I lean that way. So I'm wondering, we still have a few minutes.
I want to ask a technical question.
Yeah.
I'm curious. You mentioned a Weber grill, and you're, are you like, what about wood, like, and wood types, right? Is this or versus charcoal, or, you know, do you have, are those things regional as well?
So wood is definitely regional. So a lot of Southern barbecue will be hickory. In Texas, there's, you know, you have some hickory, but people are using usually oak or mesquite. And, you know, wood, all of these woods have different properties, right? Some burn faster, they impart a taste. The thing you're finding now is that there are more people using fruit woods because they like the perfume.
Apple wood.
I like the perfume and flavor of hickory. It's just, it's to me, amazing. There's nothing like it. Yeah. And charcoal becomes more prevalent in an urban environment. That's when you start to see more charcoal cooking with barbecue.
What about the like, when you say low and slow, like the events where it's like 24 hours, right? You have to, if you're bringing someone in to do barbecue, they have to start, you know, the day before and mind it, tend it all night. Is this a Juneteenth thing as well? Or like you said, fast and then or fast and hot and then
slow? Oh, yeah. It really depends on what's being cooked and just the technique of the person who's cooking. So the beautiful thing about barbecue that it embraces a whole lot of different techniques and things like that. So believe it or not, you can still do low and slow over direct heat, but you have to have a very slow fire and somebody has to be minding it. And usually what happens is there's a second fire that's kept to replenish the coals at a certain, but that's artistry. That's somebody understanding fire management, understanding what they're cooking. Because I've seen a lot of whole hogs cooked right over meat, like, and that takes hours. So it really just kind of depends.
Well, and it does produce, like, you know, the little burnt ends. the best crackling. Part.
Yeah.
Yes.
Adrian, did you? I was poking around a little bit, and this is also because it's obviously an interest of mine. I don't know if how much you've been to Pennsylvania or if it's featured in some of your books. I did find. This one interesting person who has his name is something Woy Weaver, but he has a seed bank. He's a food ethnographer. Yeah. William Woy Weaver, I think is his name.
William Woy's Weaver.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, there are very, you know, we see this in a lot of ways. There's just very distinct regions in Pennsylvania. And I don't know if every state's like that. I know Colorado's kind of got the East and the West, but Union County, like Lycoming, is not really in what he defines as the Pennsylvania Dutch region. It's on his map as the Northern Tier, although I have no idea what would define Northern Tier cooking. Anyway, I'm just wondering, you know, do you know anything about Pennsylvania culinary history and or Juneteenth? I mean, I imagine Philadelphia has its own traditions because it's been such a hub of African-American culture and history for so long. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. So I have been to Pennsylvania. I wrote about it a lot in my soul food book and also in my president's book. For different reasons. So I've been mostly to Philadelphia several times. I've been to Pittsburgh once, mm-hmm. And that's the extent. So this is my first time kind of going to central Pennsylvania. You know, I couldn't find any emancipation traditions for Pennsylvania. I just couldn't find it. A lot for the 4th of July and other holidays, but I just couldn't find any. Doesn't mean that there's not any, but I just couldn't find any. But I'm sure if you gave me an afternoon to just look through historical Pennsylvania newspapers, I could definitely find some. So I think that's why there's fertile ground for Juneteenth in Pennsylvania, because there really aren't strong traditions that connect the same way to African-American culture. So it's a great one to introduce. And, you know, with all that's being planned, it's going to be a lot of fun. Plus all that food, man. I mean, who can turn down generous platters of red velvet cake? Who's going to turn that down?
Sam?
I just want to point out that, again, just emphasize that a lot of people think, oh, especially Union County, oh, that's so white. And so how is this related? And this is related to anyone who lives in the United States. This is critical. This is a critical part of our history. This is about understanding our past in a much more deep way that will help us understand our present and our future and make the future we want to see. Maybe we can even link to it. We have audio of a local historian who describes the history of slavery in Union County, which a lot of people, Bruce Teeple, he actually lives in Center County, but
he's the head of the Union County Historical. That one's always cracked me up.
Yeah. Well, Union County used to be a lot bigger anyway, like long before he was born, but yeah. It's sort of a subject area for him. And so
if you can get me the link for sure.
Yeah, he has this whole talk that he gives, and he does a close reading of a bill of sale for a person in Union County and talks about how slavery was outlawed in like the 1830s, but it still existed because they were grandfathered in, and well, don't talk about grandfathering as a term, and you know, basically it just again unrolls that. Why is it so white? What does it mean that it's so white? It's not entirely white. What were the relationships? And also, you know, later on, then you get into the whole sundown town thing, right? We have these very white towns. They didn't stay that way by chance.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, people who are listening to our podcast or from the area are probably aware of this. And I looked it up recently, you know, 4 of the 10 whitest congressional districts in the United States are in Pennsylvania. But that's not really a surprise. It's all sort of greater Appalachia. But you know, Sam, I totally agree with you. And I think Adrian said this earlier, you know, none of us are free until all of us are free. And liberation and emancipation, it's not a destination that we've arrived at as a culture and society. It's a process. And the last thing I'll say, and then I'll let Adrian and Sheree have any last words, but like, you know, Juneteenth is very new for me. We're doing something tomorrow night, and I'll put a link to that too, but we're just having kind of an open Zoom conversation about what is Juneteenth, because I think a lot of people who want to be supportive, especially white people or other people who aren't African-American, just don't know. And the folks in Williamsport, I know, and it sounds like Sheree also, are so focused on this being something they want to share with the whole community. And I don't know if that's different in places that are closer, have a larger African-American population, but, and I say this as much humility as I can bring, to my voice, but like, it's such a moment to me of making a being American a thing to be proud of, right? To be invited into that by all these African-American community people. And so I think that's a reason to participate also. If you're not African-American, you know, we're being invited in to remaking what America is. And, you know, that's about the most patriotic thing you can do, in my opinion. But Adrian, Sheree, any last thoughts on Juneteenth, food, anything?
Oh, no. I mean, thank you for the rich discussion. I'm glad we had a chance to kind of talk these things out and learn from each other. Y'all have said things that I didn't know. So that's part of the journey, right? It's about connecting. And again, I'm looking forward to being in your community and celebrating Juneteenth. So thank you.
Sheree?
A crazy background. I'm in like the airport. I'm sorry. But I'm just honored to be on the panel with Adrian. Like I loved your segment and I don't know how, and like I learned so much through that documentary. It was a part of how we crafted like our menu. Like it was just a learning experience. And Jody, the opportunity just to have this conversation. I think the more we talk about Juneteenth, the more we'll get an understanding of it and the more we'll be able to share it. So I'm just glad to be here and thank you guys for the invite.
All right, well, the music's coming on.
Waterloo, Lackawanna, Fairview, Bellevue, Sweet Roots, Susquehanna, Lewisburg, Stroudsburg, Gillesburg, Orbisonia, Harrisburg, Pittsburgh, Wellesburg, Robsonia, Mountaintop, Glen Rock, Flat Rock, Sunbury, St. Mary, Schick, Shanny, Big Shanny, I'm a Danny. I've been everywhere, man. I've crossed the valleys fair, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, ever had my share, man. I've been everywhere. Been to Bellefonte, Southmont, Westmont, Womelsdorf, Nordmont, Dormont, Lebanon, Hummels Wharf, Cedar Springs, Bowling Springs, Chess Springs, Center Bridge, Centersport, Leesport, Williamsport, Brackenridge, Lumber City, Central City, Lake City, Clearfield, Westfield, Wentfield, Richfield, Big Deal. I've been everywhere, man. I've crossed the valleys fair, man. I be the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. Beachland, Wilpen, Tunnelton, Conestoga, Bakerton, Curry Run, Smoke Run, Sanatoga, Slickville, Smithville, Flicksville, Maxtoney, Youngwood, Edgewood, Hopwood, Punxsutawney, Whitehall, Blue Ball, Center Hall, North Apollo, Telenor, Novo, Laredo, let's go. I've been everywhere, man. I cross the valleys fair, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. Been to Stump Creek, Pence Creek, Pine Creek, Chambersburg, Middle Creek, Blakesley, Falls Creek, Shepherdsburg, Johnstown, Allentown, Shepherdstown, Lords Valley, Daisytown, Doylestown, Downingtown, Cherry Valley, Plain Grove, Mill Grove, Mechanics Grove, Swiss Vale, Ferndale, Carbondale, Monongahela, oh well.
I've been everywhere, man. I cross the valley, fair, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man.